Hey everybody, Josh from A Cast of the Past here. Just wanted to let you guys know on November 7th at 3 p.m., we will be hosting a 24-hour long charity stream at twitch.tv/castofthepast. Come join us. You'll be able to see us play a whole bunch of video games as well as having a lot of fun doing live D&D campaigns, doing a live podcast, doing a full movie watch along as well. We're going to have a lot of guests and we're going to be giving away items and lots of video games as well. So stop on by on November 7th at 3 p.m. This will be for a good cause, so we hope to see you guys there. But until next time, we'll see you in the future. Welcome back, everybody, to the most spookiest time of the year, October, where we gather around and we take a trip back into yesteryear to talk about all the old and spooky games. Yes, this is A Cast of the Past where best friends get together to talk about old games in a new light. I'm Josh.
And I'm Tom.
And today we're going to be talking about the hit game Resident Evil 2.
What I think you meant to say was Resident Evil 2.
That is absolutely correct. And we are not talking about the re-release. We are talking about the good old 1998 Resident Evil 2 that came out on several consoles.
Well, yes, obviously, Josh, because the remake is not 3 years old yet, so it doesn't qualify for the podcast.
Yeah,
but
yes, it does.
The original, it's 3+ years old, so...
Oh, it's definitely 3+ years old.
Yeah, 3 and change.
So... like that. Like a lot of the games that we've been recently doing, Tom, this is your first time playing Resident Evil 2.
Yep. I think the theme of this podcast, we could easily rebrand this as like Josh makes Tom play, like, because that's been the majority of this show.
It should be just, oh my God, you haven't played that game yet?
Exactly. Well, to be fair, it's not that I've never played this game. I played maybe a half hour of this game at my cousin's house on the N64 in like 1999-2000, and I don't really remember much of it, but I do remember being like, ooh, an M-rated adult game.
Yes,
wow.
The definitive way to play this game is on the Nintendo 64.
Well, we'll get into it, but is there any real way to play this game?
I mean, the best way really to play it is on the GameCube. Unfortunately, okay. I did not play mine on the GameCube.
Yep. Let's get into it. I played a digital copy of this game on the PlayStation 3. The menu branded it as Resident Evil 2 DualShock version. So I don't know if that was like a digital copy of a second run of Resident Evil 2 where DualShock controls were incorporated.
Yeah,
but that was my
much.
Play experience. Okay. Yeah. And Josh, how about you?
The original release of Resident Evil 2. Nothing fancy, okay. Nothing crazy, just Resident Evil 2.
Well, let's get into the thrills and chills of this game. Josh, so Resident Evil, safe to say, it's on your Mount Rushmore of video game franchises?
The original trilogy, absolutely. After the original trilogy, Veronica is like a hit or miss with a lot of people. It's a great game, but it's in its weird, like, is this game getting too out of control right now with its ideas?
And then jumping the shark.
Yeah. And then they went ahead and released Resident Evil 4. Don't get me wrong. I love Code Veronica.
Well, yes, Resident Evil 4, we joke about a lot of the podcast, and we'll get into it. Someday, we'll get into that game on this podcast. Mm. I will find a way to make you talk about it. And by find a way, I mean when I win the Smash wager. Because just an update, if you're behind, I'm up one. Mm. So, Resident Evil 2, the follow-up to the acclaimed Resident Evil, directed by Hideki Kamiya. Hideki Kamiya of Resident Evil fame, Devil May Cry fame, Bayonetta fame, Beautiful Joe fame. This guy is a legend in terms of creating or being involved with unique IPs.
Yeah, Okami.
So, there you
and
go.
Wonderful just, 101.
Just keep adding on to
I
it.
Know.
So, with a track record like that, you had to expect something great from this title. So, Josh, what was your earliest experience with Resident Evil 2? I assume you played the series in order growing up.
Yes. So I played the original one on the PlayStation when it came out long, long, long time ago. And then I saw that there was a sequel and I was like, ooh, this game, this spooky game is getting a spooky sequel. And the everything that I saw from Game Pro magazines and EGMs, I was like, man, this game is going to be crazy. I'm going to love every single thing about this. And I did. Oh my God, did I ever love this game. This game, I mean, we've talked about it a long time ago. This is in my top 10 games of all time.
It is.
Hands down. This is a great game that just, it, for how simple everything is, it is still scary to this day. Just unsettling certain areas are in the game. And you're like, oh, no. It's so good. And I know usually when I keep talking about how great a game is, you're going to come back and go, well, technically, I don't think it's that great. So I absolutely
Josh,
love
not,
this game.
That is not always true.
Okay.
There are sometimes you turn me onto a game, and this podcast has shown where you've recommended something and I come to the table and I'm like, thank you, Josh.
But no, I will say that this is one of those things that the original game didn't need a sequel, and mm-hmm. yet it delivers. And, you know, it's in that traditional, well, you don't, how are you going to make a sequel to Alien? How are you going to make it a sequel to Terminator, right?
Alien is a very interesting comparison in terms of sequels with this. We'll get into that later.
But it's one of those things, though, like, it's a game that didn't need a sequel, but got it, and it outshines the original game. Hmm. And I just love it. What about you, Tom? Oh. So this is your first experience with it.
Yes, the first Resident Evil game I ever played was Resident Evil 4. And then I played Resident Evil 5 a few years later. And that was mostly it. You know, I was always aware of this franchise. You know, I knew it was one of the big ones. But I didn't have a PlayStation growing up. And then by the time the rest of them rolled around, it just wasn't on my radar. So this, 2020, first time I'm playing Resident Evil 2. And, well, we'll get into it. So, interesting thing about this game is the campaign can be played four ways between two different characters. Josh, who did you start your campaign with?
So I played as Claire. Before going into this, we discussed who we wanted to play as. And I played as Claire. You played as Leon, if I'm not mistaken, right?
I did. Okay. Yes. The two protagonists of this game. And as I just said, a bit repeating myself, but you can mix and match who you start the campaign as. And they cross paths, you know, throughout the narrative. But if you're playing as one character, you'll come through areas that you'll find out through playing as the other character, you know, circumstances or events or enemies were encountered in ways that set up the environment for how you are now approaching it. Don't want to lose anybody if you're not familiar with this game, but bear with me because I'm a noob to this as well. But we're definitely gonna get
into it. And that's why I'm here.
So Josh, I think you need to be. You think you need to shepherd me through Raccoon City. So take the lead on this, buddy. Go for it.
So,
and we'll get into this.
We are gonna start in Raccoon City. Claire Redfield's driving into town on her Harley, looking for her brother Chris. At the same time, however,
can we talk about real quick? She's driving on a Harley, wearing what might be in like the top five dumbest video game outfits of all time. That I guess were just created for the sake of making a girl look hot. but you got this polygonal character who I don't see how they could look attractive in any way possible, but she's wearing some kind of skin tight latex, like an Under Armour top, and then like bicycle shorts, and then over that she's wearing pink denim Daisy Dukes and a pink denim vest, and it's just like, who dressed you? Are you an adult? Did you do this yourself?
Like, so it's really funny, though. Once you complete the game of Claire and you see her end credit scene, I remember doing the stream, and at the end, I saw the picture, and it doesn't look like she's wearing pants at all. Like, she just has, like, a denim jacket on, but it's, like, so low that it looks like it's part of her. Like, she's not wearing any pants. I'm like, put some clothes on, girl. You're standing in front of another a young lady. Stop this. What type of role model are you being right now? Yeah, exactly. But mm-hmm. Claire Redfield's on her way to Raccoon City to find her brother, Chris, who is one of the protagonists of the original Resident Evil game. At the same time, Leon S. Kennedy is enjoying his first day on his way to the first day on his job at Raccoon City as a new recruit for the Raccoon Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
Once they both arrive into town, some weird stuff starts happening and they realize that the town is infested with zombies. As Claire is inside of a diner, she escapes out the back door where there's a man standing there with a gun. And the man's like, get down. And he shoots a zombie. And now our intro movies are exactly the same. We're in a police car being chased down or driving through the streets of Raccoon City with zombies all over the place, which is a really awesome opening. I think the introduction to this game like gets that adrenaline pumping, like knowing like, crap, like this isn't like the first one where you have slow moving zombies. This is like a whole world now of zombies built into this, where there's a zombie in the back seat now. It tries to get through, crashes the vehicle, and as you see an 18 wheeler coming down with a zombie inside of it, like going to plow into you, and it separates you two at the beginning of the game. Tom, we both go over to Kendo's gun shop, and what did you get at Kendo's?
Well, I got to back up a bit because you briefly touched upon Leon's, you know, introduction. But so, yeah, he's driving to his first day of work and he comes across a body in the road. Like he's driving this Jeep and there's this body just sprawled across the center of the street. And he gets out and like in a really chipper kind of casual vibe he's got, he goes, what have we got here? Just like how many prone people do you see in the street, I guess, in your lifetime to just be like, another case of this?
Listen, 1998 was a weird time.
Yes, yes. Also, I guess it's just a funny shift for me because when I was introduced to Leon in Resident Evil 4, he's this kind of blonde, emo, pretty boy. But in some of the cutscenes in this game, he looks like Conan O'Brien. He's got ginger hair swept to one side.
And there's sometimes where at the beginning when he reaches out and tries to take Claire's hand, he has the Sean Hunter curtains on the hair.
That's incredible. So after the crash, you know, you start and you're in the player character mode. Rob Leon. And the first thing that happened to me is I died 3 times because, Josh, whatever positive I am going to say about this game, I want to get the big negative out of the way, and it's a negative I know you don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
I think this game has terrible controls.
You are not a fan of the tank controls, I presume.
I am not a fan of the tank controls. They just feel so unnatural. And I get the logic of them. Like, you know, I eventually, like, I guess I made my peace with them. And I was like, okay, I get you. But I just don't understand why it had to operate like that, given just the standards of the era. Maybe, I assume it's because since you're moving through segmented pieces of the map where the camera angles are changing at any point, you can't have a looser control scheme because every time the camera angle changes, maybe you're technically not pressing in that direction with your character. So the tank controls make sense. It's just wherever direction your character is facing forward, up is just where they're going to move. And that is a trade-off of how the environments work in the series. But it was just so odd and so weird to get used to. And also big thumbs down for making one of the face buttons a menu access button, you know, like circle, because there's this early in the game, you know, like I'm instinctually trying to figure out how to interact with things in the environment, and I'm just like, well, what do the face buttons do? And then every time I inadvertently forget and hit circle, it's like, oh, now I gotta go to the menus, blah 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 blah. Just these are the hurdles I was overcoming as, you know, an adult used to certain kind of logic in game controls. So,
and that's actually funny that you talk about it like this, because I grew up playing these games. So this was like muscle memory coming back to me, going through and playing through the tank controls. And when the GameCube re-release came out of the first game, it still had tank controls. And when you play it now on the Xbox One and the PS4, you have the ability to still use tank controls, or you have the ability to do kind of an over-the-shoulder style free roaming move, but because of it having pre-rendered backgrounds, of course. But I don't know, like I always loved them, and I understand a lot of people's hate for the tank controls. I get it. I think that they're better in this side, the style of gameplay, than the over the shoulder third person that we end up going to for three of the games itself. But, like, I don't know. It is weird.
It's just like, not even comparing it to future Resident Evil games. Like, the most immediate comparison I can think of from its own generation would be Metal Gear Solid, which did, you know, found its own way of working around the D-pad to provide third-person combat. And again, that's why I said it has to, in my opinion, come down to the camera angles used within this game versus Metal Gear Solid, which is wide open play areas, versus this, where it's like you said, it's pre-rendered sections that right. you step into each time. And you know, I'm just saying, someone coming to it in 2020, I sit down and I just personally think this is a relic. And I understand for you have that attachment to it. Like, when we talked about Banjo-Kazooie, you were pointing out how, like, some of the controls, in your opinion, you were like, who designed this game like this? And I was like, but I love it, you know? So
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
You know, yeah.
It's weird that these two came out almost around the same time.
Yeah, yeah. But hey, that's the goal of this podcast, old games in a new light.
Yep.
All right, so my control spiel is kind of done for now. So we're in Kendo's gun shop. You know, Leon walks in and then stares for a long time behind the counter, and then hear, and then he's like, whoa, wait, I'm a human, don't. And I guess he's Mr. Kendo Kendo.
Yeah, so Kendo's the owner of the gun shop, which is really cool because he plays a little bit of a part in Resident Evil 3, but in the remakes, he's actually a little bit more of he has a story in those games, and it's pretty cool to understand what he's doing. But he is known from the Raccoon Police Department for supplying some of the weapons for them. Now, in your version, I believe you got a shotgun. Am I right?
I did not. No, and on Leon A, which is what I was playing, I did not get a shotgun until I found a safe in the police department with the shotgun in it. Yeah, Kendo Ubisoft. He just basically has a little chat with me about, like, oh, how did this happen? And then they break through the window and kill him, and I just booked it out of there. I was like, okay, bye.
What gun did he have?
He had a shotgun.
Oh, so you could actually go back. You could have killed all the zombies in there, and took his shotgun right there. So, like, in my version with Claire, he has a crossbow, which is pretty cool. It shoots three shots out. So because Claire doesn't get a shotgun. Instead, Claire gets a crossbow and a grenade launcher, where I believe Leon gets the shotgun and he'll get the upgraded pistol.
Rocket launcher? Oh, pistol?
He'll get the upgraded pistol and he can get a machine gun, depending on how you play your cards right in the game.
But I did get the pistol upgrade. You're talking about the bump stock attachment. Yep. Okay, I got that. The burst. Yes, the burst.
So,
all right,
we make our ways.
But the goal here.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same right now for a while for me and you, going through Raccoon City, getting to the police station. You get in there, you find one sole survivor inside the police station who is talking about the incident that happened 2 months ago, where Jill, Chris, and Barry were all crazy because they're talking about zombies in a mansion and shit. This is happening right now. Like,
you were warned. You were warned. You could have been spared.
Exactly.
Also, I just want to say, this dying black police officer that you're referring to has the most obviously white voice actor. Like, it's so just like, you guys couldn't find one, you know, hireable black voice actor.
Here, take this key card. Use it.
Yeah.
Use it in the computer to open the other doors. Now go.
Hello, I am a black officer. It's like, no, you're not. Sound like a Mormon.
As you traverse through the police station, do some puzzles, unlock doors. All the keys in this one are based off of cards, card emblems, diamonds, heart, spade, club. You now on yours, you come across. Now we do come across each other in the hallway after the STARS room. So you go into the actual STARS office where Jill, Barry, Chris's desk is, and Wesker's desk is in there too. And there's a little fun fact, if you search Wesker's desk 50 times, you get a little film reel that you can take down into the black room and develop it. And it's a picture of Rebecca Chambers from the first game as like her actor or whatnot in like a really skimpy basketball outfit. because Japan, right?
Good Lord. I don't know. It's things like that really make me wonder about gaming history. It's like somebody was like, yeah, I just had to do this 50 times in a row. And I'm like, you decided to do that 50 times in a row?
Well,
like,
the reason being, in order to get an S ranking, you need to develop all the film that you see throughout the entire game. And that's the last hidden one.
I know. I'm just saying it's like that classic conundrum of like, who figured out that like you could milk cows for a beverage? It's like, who's the first person to say, I should try this? Who's the first person to say, I'm going to stand in front of Wesker's desk and just hit X 50 times to see what happens,
right.
You know?
So after we
speaking of that office, I just want to talk about how freaking Chris Redfield's messy desk features not only a members only jacket, a classic relic of the 90s, but he has an electric guitar. Just, I guess he gets bored enough at his desk at his cop job. And he's like, oh, you know, that soothes my soul like an electric guitar.
So
I assume there's an amp somewhere in the room. Go ahead.
Unfortunately, I know as much as you want it to be, it is not a members only jacket.
Oh,
if you actually look at the jacket, it's the same emblem that's on the back of Claire's jacket. It's it's the guardian angel like logo thing that they have, which I believe is also part of Chris's outfit in the original game too. I could be mistaken on that one. It's been a while since I played through as Chris. But we leave the Tsar's office and we head down the hall a little bit more, unlock a door, mm-hmm. we go through, mm-hmm. and then we meet up with each other. Now, we both met up, I believe, at the same way. If you're playing through on scenario B, you're actually the one coming down in the hallway now. So okay. Once we get through there, more puzzles, stuff like that. One of my favorite parts is once you stop the fire of the helicopter and blow up the wall where the helicopter is at, you hear a woman scream coming from an office in the back there. Mm-hmm. You make your way on back and you meet Chief Irons.
Who's a real creep. He's a big old creep.
Yeah. He unfortunately was given a task to look after the mayor's daughter and he failed horribly.
If horribly, I feel like it was heavily implied that he just killed her.
Why would he have killed her, Tom?
Well, because, you know, he's involved in this deep cover up and he's also implied, I'm pretty sure, in a series of documents to possibly be a rapist, and I don't know, just the vibes off him, I was like,
so I'll give you a little backstory on Chief Irons.
Go ahead,
because like I said, I love this game.
I'm not being disingenuous, please tell me.
So from what I know of the whole Chief Irons story is Chief Irons loves taxidermy and he only wants to taxidermy the most purest and beautiful creatures.
Like the girl in the white dress with the pure pale skin who's dead on his desk.
Almost. Yeah. He pretty much was going to do that from what I've always gathered and read into. Like he was going to kill her to make her, you know, a taxidermy person.
It's a bad plan because, like, you know, he's got in his office, he has mounted deer heads and other little like critters that he's taxidermy. But like, where is he supposed to display this trophy? It's going to raise some pretty big questions when the mayor comes in for a budget meeting for the police department. He's like, hey, wait a minute. That one, that new one. I've seen that before. You know, it's not a terrible plan.
Well, it's almost like there's a dungeon underneath his office or anything like.
This is the weirdest police department in the history of the world. And it's just so funny to consider that it apparently is all by the machinations of this one man. Like, how long has he been chief that he's been able to install a fountain in the lobby with a medallion-based puzzle? How has he dragged in all of these immaculate works of art that all have secret puzzles in them? Like, imagine being an intern or just a regular staff member in that department. And it's like, oh, I can't get into the records room because the gemstone is left up on the third floor in the Hercules statue. And the boss is out today, so I don't know where to ask him about it.
Right.
Like, Irons is a creep just for multiple reasons.
So let me go back. Let's rewind a little bit. When we got into it, into the police station, we went a couple rooms in. What did you think of your first encounter with the Lickers?
Oh, with Finn Balor?
Yeah.
Very scary. Very well handled. Like, this is supposed to be us talking about spooky games. I think we should do justice to the things that were spooky in this game. Lickers are terrifying. And it took me a little bit to figure out that I kind of had to like kind of cautiously back off from it and not just immediately run away, because trying to turn around and run away with the tank controls is very clunky. But I figured out after the second time it killed me that like you have to back up to the end of the hallway, and then when the camera angle changes, then you just got to turn and run as fast as you can. What about you? Do you have memories of the Lickers from like childhood?
I always thought the Lickers were cool. The fact that their brain was on the outside, it was split and it was on the outside covering where their eyes would be, almost like they can't see you. But they can
kind of like
they,
Lickers yeah. in Last of Us.
Yeah. I thought that was terrifying. In scenario B, Mr. X was just terrifying playing through it. Because unfortunately, in scenario A, you don't really get to play as against anything of Mr. X. And Mr. X is a whole other story inside of this game. I think Mr. X is probably one of the scariest parts of this game. And, oh, man, I'm trying to think of... Oh, the alligator was was great as well.
The scariest thing in this game for me, and you know this just from a Resident Evil 3 stream that you did recently that I watched for a little bit. You go in the sewers and the freaking spiders are there, and I almost quit the game. I was like, Josh, how dare you do this to me? That like, for all the aged graphics in this game, I don't know why the spiders look so convincingly good. Just the way they move and the way the
even in the original Resident Evil, like the way that the spiders move are just so unsettling, because they do that scurry.
Yeah,
they do that spider scurry.
It's like Kamiya put all the money into spiders, and then after that, it was just like, oh yeah, we have other monsters.
we make our way out of the police station though after a series of events. Well, actually, while we're down in the lower part, I got to meet Sherry, which we have a really fun thing in our stream. Sherry is dressed as a sailor. She looks like a sailor, so we kept calling her Sherry Moon. In regards to Sherry Moon, to Sailor Moon, I mean. So
I like that.
So that's what we kept calling her in the stream. And then you got to meet the wonderful Ada Wong.
Yes, who I remembered from Resident Evil 4. And she's like, I'm looking for my boyfriend. That's totally a reason to be here.
Her boyfriend's name's John.
Yeah, wow. You came all the way to a police station to look for your boyfriend? Like, okay, nothing suspicious about that. I mean, I'm laughing at this because I know that Ada is not supposed to be trustworthy or completely like, you know, on the face from what I know from Resident Evil 4. So
now let me hit you with some fun facts though, Tom.
Go ahead.
In Resident Evil 1, when you're in the lab towards the end of the game, you find a memo from a man named John. And John is the admin username, password Ada. Code word mole. What?
That's some good planning.
That's world building right there.
Yeah, you gotta wonder. I always wonder sometimes when, like, you know, properties call their shots. You know, like Back to the Future, even before the movie was done, they, you know, they wrote that ending into the script of Doc and Marty and Jen going on a further adventure. So it's like they call their shot. It's like there's more out there for this. And they're lucky there was, because then they ended up getting sequels. So it's like Resident Evil. It's like, you're going to call our shot. We're going to put in more crap and it's totally going to get made. And we're confident about it. So you got to admire a game that does that.
Yeah. No, overall, though, I think it was awesome. The fact that, I mean, Ada was just a character that you knew from a puzzle in the first game. And it was like, you know what? We're going to make her a full-fledged character in this one. And I actually like Ada in this game, because there's a part where, like, Leon gets shot. And she just leaves him. Like, showing how trustworthy she's not.
He takes a bullet for her, specifically. And, you know, afterwards, she's just like, oh, well, bye. Like, you know, it sucks to be you. But, yes, you meet Ada, and you two start exploring the precinct together. And you run, I gotta talk about this, you run into a gentleman named, what's his face? Ben. Ben's down in the holding cells. Yep. And Ben has locked himself in a prison cell because he is convinced this will protect him from the zombies. And I immediately was just like, this is a terrible plan. you've locked yourself in a cell with no provisions. There's no food and water in there. And it also looks like a one of those common drunk tank cells. Like, there's no toilet in there. It's like, Ben, what are you going to do? Like, this zombie outbreak could last for weeks. And you're going to be dead in 3 days.
So you're talking about with meeting with Ben and stuff like that. With the whole thing with Claire and Sherry, though, Sherry is her mind. Her whole thing is trying to find her dad. And you find out her dad is William Birkin, the creator of the G virus, which is the cause of what you are experiencing now.
Oh, no. Oh. T virus caused the initial outbreak, and the G virus was the second virus. Yeah.
Well,
it was the Resident Evil. It was the Resident Evil expert here.
Hold on.
Good.
Because if I'm not mistaken, though, when they steal the samples, they step on the one vial, and the rats in the sewer are eating it. And
okay. The T virus causes the outbreak in the mansion in RE1.
Correct.
And yes, it is the botched attempt to steal the G virus by Umbrella's mercenaries that causes the breakout in Raccoon City. Yeah. Okay, I apologize.
I apologize. Hold on a second. I think we're both kind of right on this one.
Kinda.
But yeah, so Sherry is trying to find her dad, and she hears her dad always yelling for her. And it turns out that her dad's William Birkin, who was a man that was known for creating the G virus. So Sherry goes into the sewers to find her dad because she hears him screaming for her. She gets swept away, and unfortunately, this giant monster inside implants Sherry with some sort of mutation. Which is not good. So what happens on your end here? This is probably where you're in with the holding cells, getting ready to leave, going down to the parking garage, right?
Oh, yeah. Basically, you know, Leon and Ada start realizing that they need to get to the Umbrella chemical plant to suss out what's going on. And, you know, the unknown monster that you just mentioned has an encounter with Claire and Sherry in the sewers. The unknown monster, while we're out exploring, breaks into Ben's cell and through the brick wall and just cuts him to pieces, which is hilarious because Ben's plan was bad on multiple levels. But, you know, Ada and Leon come back through the area and Ben's like, hey, yeah, so I lied. I knew everything. And he gives them this document that kind of reveals more about the G virus and what Umbrella's plans for it were. So then they conclude, like, yes, we absolutely have to get to the chemical plant.
Yeah.
And so they trek out for that.
When you go to rescue Sherry in the sewers, you are greeted by a giant mutated crocodile.
Mm-hmm.
And did you also fight the crocodile, right?
Yeah.
All right. So for those of you who've played this game before, we probably know which way I did it. And since this is Tom's first time, did Tom do it the right way or did Tom take the long way? So Tom, how did you defeat the crocodile?
I just went whole hog with what ammo I had and just, I don't know. So what, like, there's a trick I could have avoided this
there
whole
is.
Conflict.
Well,
right?
No, you can't avoid it. In scenario A, you have to fight it. So when you're running back on the left-hand side of the wall, there's a tank, like an air tank. You hit the button because the emergency latch to it's done. You hit the button, it drops down on the ground and the alligator will come over, pick it up in its mouth and you shoot it and blow its entire head off.
So you jaws it.
Yeah, exactly. It's you can take a pistol, one shot, and destroy it.
Wow, you son of a... That's great.
So like I said, veteran players probably already know what way I would have done it. And that's why I figured you went guns blazing against it. Which is still... It's still fun. Like, especially when you shoot it and then it creeps back. And then it comes back up again for a second time. You're like, oh, you son of a bitch. But... I don't know. I loved it. Yeah. I love playing it both ways. I will tell you, though, it took me years till I realized that there was an alternative way to defeat the alligator. So you're not alone.
Gotcha. All right. Well, I appreciate that. I feel seen.
In the sewers, though.
Real quick.
Yeah.
You know, while we're talking about the sewers, while we're talking about Sherry, you mentioned towards the top of the episode how, like a movie like Alien, you didn't expect a sequel, and then you got Aliens. Sherry... as a character, it gives me big vibes towards the little girl in Aliens and, you know, her importance to the plot and everything like that. Newt, yes. So, especially, like, in the sewer, because Newt falls down into that underwater cavern, you know, and, like, the alien comes up out of the water behind her. So, like, big... I would not be surprised to hear if Kamiya had some big Aliens inspirations in the production of this game, because that Sherry just screams Newt to me.
So, big problem that I had in this game is Sherry. I hated Sherry. That was probably my biggest turn off of this entire game. And because when you have Sherry with you, it turns into an escort mission.
Where you hate escort missions.
But you run ahead, and if you run too far ahead, Sherry's a little kid, so she can't run as fast as you. So she stops and curls down into a ball and waits for you to come back. And then you have to walk back, get her, and then take off again, but you can't run too fast. So you're like doing like this weird like 1.5 run. Like it's like run, stop. Run, stop. And it's so annoying. But talking about Kamiya's...
And there's a moment, I know this just from some further research I did after playing Leon, but I know there's a section of this game where you have to control Sherry for a little bit because she gets separated and you're just super vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah, you have no weapons and it's so time consuming. You have to push crates, you have to climb on top of stuff, and she's short. So she like, you're climbing... like timing is almost 2 to 3 times longer than a normal person because like she lifts up, pulls herself up a little bit. She goes to put her leg and then she can't reach. So she goes to put her leg again up and then she's able to climb up again. And it's so time consuming and so long that it's so damn annoying where when you play with Ada, you get a damn pistol and you can do stuff.
Kids are dumb.
Give the kid a gun. We're in America, for God's sakes.
This is how it works.
But
your
we
first
go back
birthday. Here's your first Colt 45.
Talking about Kamiya's inspiration for like the Resident Evil games and stuff like that. Like some of his big inspirations for gaming was A Link to the Past and Castlevania, right? Like think about like the games, the exploration and the secrets and the puzzles mixed with the horrorness of Castlevania. Like I can definitely see where he's gotten a lot of that inspiration from.
Backtracking plays a big part in this game. I gotta say, like, it was a bit of a mixed bag getting used to some things because here's the thing. I'm really glad, like, say, just take within the police station, you know, zombies don't respawn. You know, when you clear a room, they're all gone. And it's good because then you're not wasting ammo. You're not, like, you know, wasting herbs and first aid spray. But the other problem is just that, like, the load times between rooms gets very annoying. Yeah. I mean, playing this PS3 port emulation, whatever you want to call it, I feel like maybe the load times were a little bit lesser than they could have been on the PS1 itself. But I'm sure even if you haven't played Resident Evil 2, you might be aware of the gimmick of you walk up to a door, hit X, and then the loading screen is a door which opens, and then like you zoom through it into darkness, and then it reloads in the next room. It's probably one of the most like it's probably a very highly referenced gaming trope. What I'm getting at is just that, like, there was a long chunk of this early game where I got lost in the police station because I couldn't find out where the Bishop plug went. It's an item that you're supposed to insert into a special thing to access a puzzle, and I couldn't figure out where the hell it went. And so I'm wandering this labyrinth, and there's no zombies, they're all dead, so I'm just wandering it in silence, going from room to room, through loading screen after loading screen. It definitely was testing my patience.
Okay.
Personally.
So, and it's strange that you got lost in the police station. I actually thought you would have gotten lost in the sewers because the sewers can get a little tricky with certain corridors and hallways and climbing up certain things and whatnot. But I mean,
what I mean by lost is just that I couldn't figure out the solution to the puzzle.
Right.
Like I understood how to read the map systems and like things like that. It's just like I went to every logical place that I thought the puzzle would be solved and it wasn't there. And I was like, what am I missing? And then when I found it, I was like, ugh.
Right. So inside the sewers, we both meet the same person and we're going to meet them at a little bit different times, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. We're going to meet Annette, which Annette is on my side, Sherry's mother, and on your side, co-creator of the G-Virus.
Mm-hmm. So, mom and pop team. You love to see it in this economy, little mom and pop business.
So what's all happening over on your side of the sewers?
Basically, it's just every time Annette shows up, she's frantic. She's the gimmick overall, the narrative, as you come to realize, is that like Annette and William were like workaholics who were obsessed with what they were creating, and they kind of were shitty parents as a result. And it's that Annette is trying to get out of here because she knows the Umbrella Corporation is coming for her next, because they already came for William to steal the G-Virus. And as far as they think he's dead, should we just reveal the spoiler about what actually happened to William?
Yeah, so, I mean, we're going to find very soon after this, once we get into the facility. But yeah, so the Umbrella Corps comes down to retrieve the sample of the G-Virus, and they gun William down. They gun him down hard. Mm-hmm. And William, with his last little bit of energy that he has, decides to inject himself with the G-Virus, becoming the monster that we see in the game, which I thought was pretty cool. Like, keep the monster a character that the characters have some sort of relationship to, where in the first game it was just, oh, this is a mutated creature that we made in a lab. This one was, oh, this is just a person who,
like, this is like a chance accident.
Right. Yeah.
But my question is, like, you know, so William created the G-Virus, and he knew that it was part of Umbrella Corporation's, you know, biological warfare program. So my curiosity after the game ended just kind of became, like, what did William think was going to happen? Like, the G-Virus wasn't made as, like, a regenerative health potion. It was made to, you know, mess things up. So I just kind of...
Wasn't it? Like, no. The G-Virus was actually supposed to help regenerate cells. So after William got shot down, that's why he injected it into himself.
See, okay. I guess I just didn't fully understand that. And I apologize for everybody who might want to school me because of that. But I could be wrong too,
but I mean,
I thought it was just weird. Like, these are weapons that Umbrella is making you make. And I was just like, so he knew his only chance to survive was to become a horrible Cronenberg monster man, you know, like.
But I like that it was a character, though. Like, the people and the characters in this game have some sort of an emotional attachment now to this monster.
Yes.
Whether it's a dad or a husband.
Yeah, Annette, the wife of William and the mother of Sherry, is trying to simultaneously, you know, like, get free of Umbrella's clutches, but also trying to, you know, get some kind of weird closure on the fact that her husband is now this terrible monster man. And Sherry doesn't really realize how important she is, because as Annette reveals, William has the ability to pass on his new monster cells through this creepy tentacle process.
Correct.
But they've come to realize that the process fails unless the recipient of the genetic monster code has the same blood type. And that is where everyone realizes, oh crap, that's why this monster is hunting down Sherry. That's why Sherry keeps hearing her father calling her. Monster William is trying to put the creepy monster mash code into Sherry.
Yeah.
Because the same blood type. And now the stakes, as you said, like, and as you, I think, rightly said, everything's been raised stakes-wise because you have this emotional family story at the center of it.
So now inside the game, though, I noticed it, and I completely forgot about it because you guys actually got it on your end. But the first time you meet Sherry, she actually has this gold pendant around her neck.
Oh, of course.
And I was like, oh, like, that's, they're calling to that a lot. And then later in the game, she didn't have it. And I was like, was that just a... Did I miss something? Like, is that just a glitch? Which, she, on your side, she drops it when you're playing as Ada.
She drops it at some point, and Ada finds it, opens it up, and sees inside the pendant. It's a locket with a picture of the family, you know, William, Annette, and Sherry.
Mm-hmm.
But later, Annette has this gunpoint standoff with Ada, and Annette notices the pendant around Ada's neck and is like, what the F, why do you have that? And after this little scuffle is over, Ada opens it up and realizes that under the picture, there's a little secret panel, and there is a sample of the G-virus in the pendant.
Which was a pretty cool reveal, though. Like, the fact that the person who was looking for it had it the whole time. Like, so, like, Ada could have just stopped a long while ago and just like, oh, shit.
Doing all this work for nothing.
So now, let me, on your side, when we get to the facility, when we actually get to the underground plant.
Yeah.
The game pretty much flies through this area here, which is crazy, because I really like exploring the plant. I think there's a lot of fun stuff in here. The plant monsters are cool. There's some fun puzzles. There's some hidden puzzles as well, with particular key cards and using thumbprint scanners and stuff like that. It's all really cool. So Ada ends up dying, though. On my side, we just go through Sherry. We're taking a trip down an elevator shaft, like inside of like a big like machinery thing. Sherry's not feeling so great. We fight with William on the platform.
Because that becomes a new ticking clock, is that Sherry constantly keeps mentioning like, oh, I don't feel good, oh, I have a tummy ache, and you realize she did get infected with the monster genetics, and she might be on the verge of like alien style splitting
the same
out
way
of
that Chief Irons got taken out.
Which
was
forgot to mention that Chief Irons dies because you briefly see him get
impaled, you know, with one of
zombie,
the
zombie impregnated. But because he didn't match the blood type, it fails. Anyway, back to where we were.
Yep. So Sherry's not feeling good. You go and create a vaccine, which is good. We got the vaccine. I make the vaccine. I don't think you make the vaccine. You grab Sherry, though, right? No, you don't take Sherry. You do?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Okay. You grab Sherry and took her down to the elevator.
You move her. You take her to the cable car. Train or whatever.
I did that, or you did that?
I did that. Okay. I take her to the train.
Okay. Just double checking to make sure that our stories match up here. And then as we're leaving,
who could have imagined, Josh? Who could have imagined that in a game with four possible outcomes, and we were only each playing one of each, that we would get confused on the way?
Yeah. So on our way out of the facility, we fight Birkin, mano a mano, inside of like a nice little like generator room, and you defeat them, leave, and head out into a subway train that's on its way out as the building's getting ready to self-destruct.
Yeah.
As you leave, your thing goes out into the sunset, and
we have this little conversation.
Yeah. It's a little chuckle. We give Sherry the vaccine, and
of course,
she's all good. She's all healthy. Now we're all excited, all happy together. And then we get the credits as we escape, as the facility is crashing around us. So now I'm going to go into scenario B a little bit here.
Okay.
We enter in through the back of the Raccoon Police Department. We don't go through downtown.
Who's we in this one?
Either one of us in B.
Okay.
So just hear me out. we go through the back of the Raccoon Police Department. We do a couple extra alternative puzzles that we see. Inside of it, though, Umbrella is dropping this creature inside of the Raccoon Police Department called Mr. X. And he is hunting you and chasing you down throughout the entire police department. So it's pretty cool. And he is, think about an early stage of Nemesis almost. Where he's
I've seen him. I've seen pictures of him in the big black trench coat.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yes.
So
I get the.
So he's pretty much following you throughout the entire scenario B. Some different stories here and there. Nothing super crazy. When you get towards the end, though, this is where the main difference is. You don't fight Birkin at all. You fight Mr. X outside of the train. And if you're playing with Leon, which the correct way, the more canon way to play the game is Claire A, Leon B.
That's considered like the official.
That's the most legit canon because it's Claire saving Sherry, creating the vaccine, fighting Birkin, giving her the vaccine, while Leon is with Ada. Ada ends up getting killed. I can't remember how she dies in this, in that scene. She might be get tossed off of the generator room in that one. She gets tossed off, I think. But outside, before you get the train running, you have to fight Mr. X one last time. And he's like super mutated and crazy. And at the end of that, there's a woman who screams, "Here, use this." And you look up and it's a silhouette of Ada. So Ada didn't die in the thing. And she kicks over a rocket launcher for you to use and destroy Mr. X.
Just like she does in Resident Evil 4.
Right. So you start the train up and cut to the scene then of Claire running out to get into the train, or Leon running out, whichever way you play it in B. They get on. They give Sherry the vaccine. Everyone, ha 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 ha, cuts to black. Boom! The train shakes again. What's that? They run into the back car. Mr. X, super mutated, is now in the back of the train, where it's trying to come through and kill everything inside the train now. So you're working on fighting it, killing it, destroying it, and then releasing that part of the train off back into the explosion inside the building as the train goes out into the sun on the outskirts of Raccoon City. And they all get out and they all talk. They all have a hoot and a holler, and they get out and they just walk off into the sunset or the sunrise, I guess, because it's morning now for them.
Yes.
And that
the long night is over.
That concludes Resident Evil 2. Which is B is the extended ending to it. And there's a lot in there, which is awesome and fun. But yeah, just quick little rundown of the two. I highly recommend, if you guys don't already know, I highly recommend you guys play this game because it's awesome. It's a game that gives you four different games inside of it, too.
I get it. I understand. Look, for its time, like if this game just had the one straightforward narrative, I would say it's probably not worth buying. It's the encouragement to go back and try it again and see things you didn't see and put the pieces together that I think is pretty interesting for its era. And I dig it for what it was trying to do. But if this kind of thing happened today, I'd be like, what are you doing? Like, I'd just be like, what is this crap?
Right.
So, yeah.
What are some things you liked about the game, Tom?
I want to ask you a question about tone in Resident Evil 2. And I guess maybe this is a then versus now thing. So, like, you know, without having actually played Resident Evil 1, I frequently will make jokes at you about, like, oh, you were almost a Jill sandwich. Like,
yeah.
How Resident Evil 1 has this goofiness to it. And that's attributed, at least as far as I know, to just the dub was bad. Like, the American voice cast were not directed to take it seriously or things like that. So there was goofiness in there. But this having, you know, this degree of prestige, you know, it's the sequel to a hit game, you'd think there's just a couple moments of, like, I guess the way I put it down my notes is, like, is this goofy and quote-unquote bad in a couple points because the limitations of voice acting and cutscene production of the era? Or was the intention to be, like, a little bit campy, a little bit, like, tongue-in-cheek?
I think it was the first one because
limitations of the era, you think?
I do. Yeah. Because I think it's what they had at their disposal. Mm-hmm. They didn't really have, there wasn't, you know, when you think of the 90s in video games, like, who do you think of for voice acting? Right.
Just like whoever you can find on a local ad, I guess.
Right.
You
know, it's like, not like it is nowadays. So you have so much limitations to it. And it's like, okay, well, you're this type of character. What would they sound like? And that's one thing when we did the Resident Evil 3 playthrough, when I talk about how Carlos was like, oh, all the ladies love me, blah, 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 blah. And it's like so cheesy and campy. But is it just the way that that character was written, or is it the way that they portrayed the character?
I think it's significant, if you don't mind me just jumping in here real quick, just because, like, you know, the era of Resident Evil I got introduced into was like grimdark and serious, and like it wasn't as like, I mean, the little dwarf Napoleon guy in Resident Evil 4 is like pretty comical, but you know, beyond that, everything's played very, you know, seriously. And I don't know if the Resident Evil 2 remake, you know, like darkens up and like makes everything super serious. But it's just like, you know, like it's what I mentioned at the top of Leon's introduction, where it's like, what have we got here in the middle of the road? And just other cutscenes or moments where it's like the way people talk or interact. Or like, oh, when Leon and Claire are driving in the car at the beginning of the game, and he's like, open the glove box. And she's like, there's a gun in there. It's like, there's, you know, like things like there. That, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So no, this isn't a criticism. It's a question. You know, it's like, what was the, was this executed for one reason or another? You know, that's just basically what I'm getting.
No, I think, like I said, I think it was based off of the limitations of what they had. And like I said, what we had in general in the late 90s in gaming.
Yep. So things I liked a couple of the monster designs. I thought there was some really creative stuff in here. The liquors are really cool. I really enjoyed the way that Monster William kind of evolved. You know, like the menu, the main menu screen has this eyeball, and you're kind of wondering, like, so what's that iconic like thing that you put on the menu screen? And then like when you meet him, he's got like a little, he's got a giant eyeball on his bicep, and then the end like, of as that he one, mutates.
Yeah, it's the end of that one cutscene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as he mutates, you see the way that like his mutation is making him grow new parts and everything, and just figuring out how this monster's coming together. I thought that was really interesting. There was a couple instances of really good implementation of the fixed cameras system within this game. As we mentioned earlier, this game takes place within pre-rendered areas that are mostly interactive. It kind of reminds me of old Hanna-Barbera cartoons where they would paint animated cells and then put the pieces that actually were going to move on top of it. So like, if you've ever watched the classic Scooby-Doo cartoon and Scooby and Shaggy on the run, we're like, where, we need to find a clue. And the clue is the thing that like obviously sticks out. There's moments like that in this where it's like, I walk into a room and I'm really like, oh, I could pick that up because it's, you know, it's clearly an object and not part of the pre-rendered background. In terms of these pre-rendered camera, fixed camera rooms, there was two really, just early on moments I loved. There's a part where Leon's heading towards a bus before he gets to the police station. He's going to cut through a bus to get over some debris. And, you know, he walks past a restaurant, and then the next camera cut is this low angle shot of a group of about four zombies just feasting on somebody. And, you know, like the easiest route is just kind of walk around them. It's like, they're distracted, let them go. But it's just like, that's like a great piece of cinematography within a gameplay section. It's like, wow, that's such a greatly, that's such an amazingly constructed shot to kind of sell the chaos of Raccoon City and how everything's just gone to hell and you're just walking through this mess. I love that. Like, that was just a visual moment that struck me.
And what about the other one?
Oh, there was some moments where I appreciated where the camera was put for the sake of gunfights. You know, like there's a section where you walk through an alleyway and the camera is like bird's eye view right down on top of you.
Right next to the basketball court.
Yeah. And it's great because it allows you to kind of like see encroaching enemies a lot easier. And they do that a couple of other times throughout the game. Like, I just felt like, oh, it's like they thoughtfully considered where the camera should go for the sake of gunfights at this specific part. And I was like, thank you, game. Thank you. Good job.
So some things that I liked in the game were the jump scares. There were some really good jump scares in this game.
Where the arms come through the boarded up parts of the one hallway. That was a good awesome. Jump scare.
The interrogation room.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you walk in on the one side and it's completely normal. You can see into the other room and there's nothing in the other room, and you go grab your stuff, come out. Later on, when you go into the other side of the room, you see the mirror. There's nothing there, but when you come back out, the liquor jumps through the glass at you, and it was like, oh my god.
It was,
like, so in
that's so good.
In scenario B, because it doesn't happen in A, in scenario B, when you go up to the room next to the helicopter crash, you put the two gems into the plates to get the night chest to move. But the way that the camera is, the first time when you come through, and A, it's positioned on the ground looking up into the puzzle and the sky that you see, right? Because there's a big glass like painting on the sky. When you come through an A, you just do the puzzle and you leave. On B, when you do it and you come out, a liquor falls through the sky roof.
Oh, that's great.
It's so good. just the quick jump scares that has, because you're like, oh crap, like you didn't even expect it to happen like that. But yeah, so I just love the jump scares, and some of them still hold up to this day, because like I said, it's not playing it or playing it for the first time, like man, like this game was ahead of its time when it comes to world building, when it comes to unique gameplay designs, you know, going into the 21st century of what we end up getting when we go to the PlayStation 2 era and so on. But I don't know. So closing statements, Tom, would you recommend this game?
I want to play the remake before I answer that question. And you gave me a copy, and now I'm going to play it because I played this. This is really tough for me, because like there's a lot of times in this thing where I will at least say, well, as a piece of gaming history, you should experience it. You know, I liked it, and I liked where the story went enough that I eventually just got over my gripes with the gameplay. I'm like, sincerely, I liked the story this told. I just think the controls are of its time, and you know, we've done better. So I would say play this as like a piece of gaming history, and keep that in mind in the best and worst ways. But Josh, yeah, I imagine you're going to emphatically recommend this.
So 100%, I do recommend it. But I will say, the Resident Evil 2 remake is not only the greatest video game remake ever made, it is also one of the scariest video games ever made. So everything that you like about this game, Tom, it's the same damn story.
Can I ask you one question?
Okay.
We're talking a lot about this. We're talking a lot about the 2019 remake. We mentioned it. You mentioned it earlier. Tell me about the GameCube version of this. What does it really entail? Is it a port? Is it a polished port? What is the GameCube version? Talk to me about it.
So not really. I mean, the big thing of the GameCube version, it was just a cleaner, smoother rendering of the game itself. The audio design, I think, was probably the cleanest that it's been too. It's just like more of like the definitive release of the PlayStation 1 version.
So it still plays the same way, with walking room to room with different camera angles.
Yep. Yeah, nothing's changed really in the gameplay side of it. It's the same game that you know, but it's like when you go from a VHS to a DVD.
Upscale and quality.
Yeah.
But the core thing is still there.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So interesting. Interesting. Okay.
But yeah, like I said, I recommend it. Tom enjoys the story. I highly recommend anyone who has any interest in Resident Evil or horror games during the month of October to play the Resident Evil 2 remake. You can get it pretty cheap nowadays. And the game, I know when I played through it the first time, took me about 5-6 hours total, but God, is it worth it? It only has a scenario A and a scenario B, just one full thing. You can still do the four stories technically, but it's the most ideal way to do it is Claire and then Leon. So until next time, this has been Josh
and Tom,
and we'll see you in the future.
Well, that's all the time that we can spend in the past, so thanks for listening. Subscribe to A Cast of the Past on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. And stay up to date with A Cast of the Past by making sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. There you can be the first to know when new episodes drop, as well as joining in on discussions on all things gaming. And until next time, we'll see you in the future.